The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
I had decided to go to Gitmo. I said I was going to go for 6 months. I ended up staying for a year and a half. And the reason I ended up staying for a year and a half was that I just felt, you know, with every day, I just felt this increasing sense of responsibility to the whole process. Like, I was talking to these detainees who, some of whom wouldn't talk to anybody but me, or I was finding translations that weren't correct, and I was, you know, spending all this time retranslating. And so I just felt this real responsibility to stay and make something good out of a really bad situation.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 18th, 2020. Jasmine El Gamal is a non-resident senior fellow with the Middle East program at the Atlantic Council. Between 2008 and 2015, she served as a Middle East advisor in the Office of Secretary of Defense, and later as a special assistant to three undersecretaries of defense for policy. She is the author of a recent article in New Lines magazine entitled Lost and Found in Guantanamo Bay, Two Encounters with Two Different Men in the Most Notorious Detention Facility in the World, Shaped My Faith and My Life Forever. She joined me from London in the Virtual Jungle Studio to talk about the article, how she ended up as a young woman as a translator at Guantanamo and in Iraq, what she's done since, and how the experience at Guantanamo shaped her later policy career, as well as her view of America, Islam, and counterterrorism. It's the Lawfare Podcast, December 18th, Jasmine El Gamal on what she lost and found at Guantanamo. So Jasmine, I want to start with something you don't talk about in the article, which is, you know, the article sort of starts when you're working at the Defense Department and you ask to be transferred to Guantanamo. But I want to start with the question of how you ended up at the Defense Department, first in Iraq at all, as a young person who was in 2002, 2003. How did you end up working for the Pentagon and asking for that transfer to Guantanamo?
Right. So I actually wasn't working for the Defense Department at the time. That didn't come until a few years later. I was working as a translator, as a contractor, basically, for a private company that, you know, contracted with the U.S. government to send them translators to embed with the military in all these various places that they were going. And the way that I got into that was just the most random thing that you'll ever hear. But I had just graduated from undergrad and I was working a few different part-time jobs that were very, very unglamorous. And I came home one day from work, and I was living in New York at the time, and I had a letter that was addressed to me in the mail. And, you know, to this day, I don't know how they got my name and address, because no one else in my family got this letter. It was just me. And it basically said, it was from this company, and it said, "Do you speak English? Do you speak Arabic? Do you like to travel?" That was it. And so, of course, I picked up the phone and I said, you know, I answered yes to all of those questions. And then 2 months later, found myself at Fort Benning, Georgia, getting ready to deploy somewhere. I didn't know where at the time, but I would learn later that it was to southern Iraq.
And so you were at the time 23?
Then I was about 20 or 21 because I was in Iraq a couple of years before I went to Gitmo.
And what were you doing in Iraq as a 20-year-old translator?
So I actually ended up being assigned to the 82nd Airborne Division. So initially the company said they took great pains to inform me or reassure me that I was going to be sent to Kuwait because, you know, Iraq was too dangerous to send a young woman and I would basically just be working in an office translating papers. And so when I got to Kuwait, within 5 minutes of being there, this guy in a clipboard came over to the group of translators I was with and says, you know, Jasmine Al-Gamal. And I said, yes, that's me. And he said, come with me. You're going to Iraq with the 82nd Airborne. And I was just so clueless at the time. I literally had to call someone I know and ask what the 82nd Airborne Division was because I just had no idea. And they put me in a truck and drove me to this base in Kuwait and introduced me to the team that I would be working with. And within a couple of minutes of making the introductions, a Scud missile alarm went off on the base and everyone just yelled, you know, cover, cover. And someone just grabbed my arm, ran me over to a bunker. And I just remember being huddled in this bunker with these guys, you know, wearing a gas mask and chemical gear, because of course, back then we thought we were going to find chemical weapons in Iraq. And I just remember huddling in this bunker with this gas mask over my face, like breathing really heavily and just wondering what the hell was going on.
And so this was before the invasion of Iraq or after?
So this was literally like in the run-up to the invasion. So I think it was maybe the next day or the day after when we drove into southern Iraq from Kuwait. It was the initial days of the invasion. So I think you'll remember the 82nd Airborne. And if I remember correctly, the 101st went in from the north, I want to say, or closer to Baghdad. And the 82nd Airborne was driving from Kuwait into Iraq. So that was the initial invasion.
And so to situate this article, I want you to give a little bit of an outline of your career, because this article is a kind of retrospective on these 2 years that you spent in Guantanamo and what you took from it. You don't talk about it in these terms, but, you know, as a policy hand, as a Muslim American, as a Muslim. And I think it's helpful in the context of talking about this article to talk a little bit about who you have become subsequently. So skip over for now the article and give us the Who is Jasmine story.
Okay, I don't want to bore your listeners, so I won't start from the very beginning. But, you know, like many others, you know, whether they were Muslim or not, I think I was part of a generation that was deeply, deeply affected by 9/11. Not to imply that, you know, not everybody was affected, but, you know, just affected deeply from a sense of, okay, what do we do now? Like, what is our role? Like, what do we do about this? What do we do with this information and this event that just happened? And you remember a lot of people signed up for the military at the time. Some people joined extremist organizations. I mean, everybody dealt with it in a different way, trying to figure out what their place was in this new world that we were living in. So when 9/11 happened, I was actually still an undergrad and I was studying abroad in Sweden at the time. And I remember being in the library and a group of my friends just running into the library saying, you know, Jasmine, your city's been bombed. Your city's been bombed. And I was just like, what are you talking about? You know, and I remember a group of us ran over to a friend's apartment that was on campus and turned on the TV just in time, just at the moment the second plane was hitting the World Trade Center. And I think we had all assumed that the first plane was an accident. But then when we saw the second plane, I just sort of sat down and I mean, my mind was reeling and I just was like, it was just very surreal. I just had this out of body experience. And of course, I'm from New York. And so my family was there and I was trying to reach them and all the phone lines were busy. And it was just a very weird experience. So that's sort of what kicked off my life, you know, everything that happened after that. So, you know, I decided to go sign up with this company. I ended up going to Iraq and Gitmo. But it was while I was at Gitmo I mean, I studied marketing and psychology in school. I certainly didn't think I was going to become a policy person with the US government, let alone the Pentagon. And so what happened when I was at Gitmo, so I had decided to go to Gitmo. I said I was going to go for 6 months. I ended up staying for a year and a half. And the reason I ended up staying for a year and a half was that I just felt, you know, with every day, I just felt this increasing sense of responsibility to the whole process. Like, I was talking to these detainees who, some of whom wouldn't talk to anybody but me, or I was finding translations that weren't correct, and I was, you know, spending all this time retranslating. And so I just felt this real responsibility to stay and make something good out of a really bad situation. But after about a year and a half, I mean, it really took its toll mentally. And I think I hinted that in the article a little bit. You know, I wasn't sleeping. I started having insomnia, which stays with me to this day. I felt like I had sort of outstayed whatever utility I was able to provide at that point. And so I decided then to go to grad school in Washington, D.C., because at the time I thought I would become a foreign service officer at the State Department. Because I wanted to just, what I wanted and what the vision I had was becoming a foreign service officer, you know, being stationed in embassies, hopefully in, you know, preferably in the Middle East, and trying to do what I was doing in Iraq and Guantanamo, which is kind of acting as a bridge between these both sides, which I felt both existed inside of me, and trying to kind of explain one side to the other. Because what I saw in Iraq and in Gitmo was that so much of what was happening, I felt was happening on the basis of misunderstandings or lies or, you know, unsuccessful attempts at communication. So I applied to 4 schools in DC, and I said, you know, if I get into any of them, I'm leaving Gitmo. And so I ended up getting into Georgetown, to the Foreign Service Program in Georgetown. And that's when I left. And so I did my 2 years at Georgetown. And then ended up working at a think tank. And then while I was working at a think tank after graduation, I ran into a friend who used to work at that think tank who was just about to leave his job at the Office of the Secretary of Defense. I ran into him at a conference and I asked him what he was doing. And he said, you know, I basically advise the Secretary of Defense on Iraq and I travel around with him. And I just remember thinking, well, I want to do that. I mean, I could do that. And so it just sounded like the perfect fit for me. And back then, I was lucky enough that the Pentagon had gotten authorization to hire people, kind of like a private sector hiring process. So I didn't have to go through USA Jobs or any of that really complicated hiring stuff. I just had an interview. I got hired under this authority, and then I just started working there.
And how long were you at the Defense Department?
From 2008 until 2017. So from 2015 to 2017, I was loaned over to the Atlantic Council. So I wasn't at the Pentagon physically, but I was still part of the employee roster. But physically in the Pentagon doing, you know, Middle East stuff and being special assistant to the undersecretary, that was from 2008 to 2015.
All right. With that as background, let's talk about the article. I mean, the title of the article is Lost and Found in Guantanamo. And so I guess I want to start with the question of what did you lose and what did you find?
Just a sense of who I was, really, and what my place was and sort of what my purpose was. You know, when I arrived at Gitmo, I just was still kind of shell-shocked from being in Iraq and didn't really understand what was going on and, you know, why we were taking all these people from one place to the other, why there was even a war in Iraq in the first place, what was Guantanamo Bay, who was there, and why were we being told the truth about everything? I mean, I just, you know, everything was just so unclear, and, you know, including who I was and what that meant for me as a person, as a Muslim American. You know, a lot of the conversation back then was, you know, this very kind of, why do they hate us? Us versus them kind of conversation. I still remember, I think it was a Newsweek cover that basically the headline on the cover was, why do they hate us? And I just remember staring at that and just saying, what does that even mean? Like, who's they and who's us? Presumably you're talking about Muslims, but like, and us is the Americans, but I'm Muslim and American. So on which side do I belong on? Am I the us? Am I the them? And in a sense, I think a lot of Muslim Americans felt at the time and still continue to feel that we don't belong in either of those categories because each side sees us as the other side. So the very, very first article that I ever wrote, the very first op-ed I wrote was after the Charlie Hebdo attacks. And I said something like, you know, in a world that is defined by the question, why do they hate us? We are seen as the other by both them and us. And it was a really frustrating and confusing place to be because we were rejected by both sides, attacked by both sides, but at the same time, feeling a responsibility to be on some side, you know, or it was so confusing. And so that was, you know, when I went to Gitmo and I saw presumably the us and them. So the, you know, them were the detainees, us were the American soldiers, but I empathized and I felt kind of connected to both of them. You know, the detainees were Muslim, the Americans were American, and I just lost a sense of certainty about who I was and where I belonged. And that was why I was so envious of the man in the wheelchair that I talk about, because he just felt such certainty about who he was and what he believed in. And I just felt really, I just envied that certainty, and I really wanted to try to find it.
So tell that story for listeners who have not read the article yet.
So it was one of the very first interviews. So I, to make it clear, like there were a lot of different things going on in Guantanamo. So they were, you know, there were the interrogations that were intelligence gathering exercises, but then there was also this whole separate process that was called the administrative review boards. And it was basically, it was not a legal process in the sense that it wasn't a court with, you know, attorneys and formal charges that were being levied against the detainees. It was an administrative process that in a war, in a conflict, typically takes place on the battlefield, right? Where you determine whether that person in front of you is what they call an enemy combatant or not. And then you deal with them based on that basis. But because there was such a fog of war, you know, in those early days in Afghanistan, what ended up happening most of the time is that these detainees, you know, these people, these Arabs, were just rounded up and sent to Gitmo, where no one really knew what to do with them, right? So for a couple of years, they were just there. And then eventually, they were placed in front of these administrative review boards to present the allegations against them by the U.S. government and give them an opportunity to address those allegations. They were able to call witnesses, which you can imagine was very difficult, if you know, since their relatives often were still in Afghanistan and stuff. So it was not a perfect process by any means, not even close. But it was some sort of process, and it was a voluntary process. So the detainees didn't have to. And a lot of the lawyers and human rights organizations that had gone to Gitmo to take up these detainees' cases pro bono were in fact advising them not to take part of the process because it wasn't an internationally recognized process. And so they didn't want the detainees to implicate themselves or even just give validity to validate the process. So that was where I was working. So I was a translator, you know, during these board hearings, basically for both sides. And I also became a cultural advisor to the US side, kind of telling them, you know, giving briefings about Islam and Muslim culture and Arab culture so that they could have that context as they were making these decisions about the detainees. So one of my first interviews, so I ended up interviewing over 100 Arab detainees as part of this process and sort of taking down their stories. And so one of the first interviews I had was with this old man in a wheelchair. And I remember going into his cell and seeing him kind of really frail and hunched over. And he was obviously paralyzed and sitting in this wheelchair and just feeling like this rush of emotions, right? Like this rush of conflicting emotions in the sense that I was just looking at a man who was paralyzed, knowing how flawed the process was at Gitmo. So on one hand, knowing that he was accused of something really terrible, but also not knowing if that was even true because the process had been so hurried and flawed. So, you know, looking at him with empathy, but then kind of hating myself for, you know, feeling that I was weak for empathizing with him or looking at him with anything other than hatred and revenge or anything like that. And I remember asking him what had happened to him. And he, you know, told me the Americans did it. And I, again, just really didn't know whether to believe him or not and felt really guilty about that. And then he could see that I was really struggling. And then he said something in Arabic that Muslims say, and I think a lot of people of faith say, which is that, don't worry, you know, my daughter, he said, this life is only 1 minute compared to the next one. You know, in the sense that the afterlife is the real life. You know, this is the life where we're tested on earth by God, and we have to do all these things, you know, right and wrong. And then we go and then we die. And then we stand there in front of God on judgment day, and he judges us for what we've done on earth and decides where we get to live, you know. And so that's what he said. He said, don't worry, this life is only 1 minute compared to the next.
And what do you think of this interaction in retrospect? So you describe it in the story, in the piece, in your reaction at the time to it. But in retrospect, when you look back on that guy, paralyzed, helpless, subject to the processes, military processes over which he has no control and very limited ability to influence, and accused of these horrible things, and yet completely stalwart in his belief in his righteousness and innocence. Which of the emotions that you described having, anger at yourself for weakness, empathy, confusion, which of them ultimately wins out? We're almost 20 years later, 18 years later. How do you feel about that guy now?
You know, to tell you the truth, Ben, I still feel all of those feelings, because if there's one thing I sort of learned, and this is when I say like lost and found, the found part, it's a very unsatisfactory answer, because I think that, you know, people really just want answers and they want conclusions. You know, nobody wants to hear that the answer is, I don't know, or there is no right answer, or I don't know, you know, I don't know what the answer will be. Maybe it'll take another 20 years. But, you know, so the confusion is still there. The sadness and the empathy and the anger is still there. It's placed a little bit differently now. I mean, I feel angry, you know, and I'm not a political person at all. Like when I worked at DOD, I was a civil servant, not a political appointee. I try to stay out of politics altogether, but I felt angry at, you know, the U.S. administration at the time for rushing into something without really, you know, taking stock of what it would mean for so many millions of people, Americans and non-Americans alike. I mean, it was such a knee-jerk reaction to go into war without really having, you know, a lot of the information that you would hope one would have before they go into war. But at the same time, that anger is tempered by also feelings of sympathy on the side, you know, on the part of Americans, in the sense that we also felt attacked and helpless and afraid. And, you know, I mean, we were attacked in our own country. It's something that hadn't happened since Pearl Harbor, I think. And I just, I realized that when you feel that helpless and afraid, you want to do something to wrest back some control over your life. And you don't really have the luxury at the time in your mind to think about other people and the implications that it would have on them. And so if you look at the implications of the war on terror and the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, and you look at everything that's followed since then, you know, the war in Syria, the conflict in Syria, the refugee crisis, you know, we're still in Afghanistan. And, you know, so you can't help feeling angry at the people who made those decisions, because they were such bad decisions in retrospect. But I think even a lot of us at the time understood and knew that these were just not great decisions, and that they were fear-based. And so the confusion is still there. The anger is still there. The only thing I would say I know, you know, that I didn't know then, is that it's okay not to pick a side. It's okay to feel that you don't have to pick a side, and that you can just be yourself and kind of try to do your best in that knowledge that, you know, when people tell you, you know, you have to choose, or are you Muslim? Are you American? Where do your loyalties lie? Like, actually, your loyalty lies, or let me just speak for myself, like my loyalty lies to my own identity and my true self and the work that I do based on that. Like my loyalty lies to, you know, to the truth and to fairness and justice and all these things that sometimes sound very wishy-washy or soft to people, but that's just where I am.
So you describe in the piece a second interaction at Guantanamo that was similarly foundational for you. Tell us about that one.
Right. So the first time after the interview with the guy in the wheelchair, I became very, very religious in the sense that, you know, I started praying again. You know, I just really wanted to find that peace in faith and in my belief in God. And because I was born Muslim, I chose that. I sort of doubled down on that identity as a vehicle through which to practice my faith. And I was feeling really calm and at peace. And I started to feel some of that certainty that man was talking about. And I felt really good. And then one day, this expert, quote unquote, I have to put that in quotations because he was billed as a terrorism expert. And he was brought in from Washington, D.C., which I had never been to at the time. So I assumed that if you're coming from Washington, you know what you're talking about and you really are an expert.
And you're at this point, like, still like 23 or 24, right?
Yeah. So I was either 22 or 23. I can't remember. Yeah, I was around that. I think I was 23, maybe.
But still very much at the age, not to be patronizing to the 22-year-olds who were listening, but still very much at an age where somebody shows up where you're a young person working and is billed as an expert on such and such, and that's meaningful to you. You kind of haven't become quite yet jaded about what the word expert means in Washington.
Right. And one of the things that, you know, I don't think came out in the piece because I was trying not to make it about policy. Maybe that's another piece. But, you know, years later, when I would work on issues like extremism or radicalization, and I would find it very frustrating when a lot of the folks in charge of policy were, you know, would very quickly resort to ideology as a reason for why a lot of people, you know, become radicalized or choose to commit violent attacks or anything like that. And it was, you know, you always hear that in the West and especially in DC, you know, it's all about the ideology. We have to fight the ideology. And I just always, you know, what I try to do in my conversations with leadership, in my writing, is try to paint a picture of what happens when you are someone who is lost and trying to find your identity and trying to find your purpose, because really there are very few things that are worse than not feeling like you have meaning and purpose in life. You know, it's like, why do you even wake up if you don't know what it is you're supposed to do? And what does your life even mean if you don't know what its purpose is? Like, everything sort of loses its color and everything is just meaningless. And so, you know, when you're in that zone, whether you're 22 or 42, and someone comes to you and they say, this is what it's all about, this is what life is all about, you sort of just grasp at that because you'll do anything and you'll listen to anybody who has that much certainty. And so, you know, so when that expert came, he was supposed to give a presentation about radical Islam. And his entire presentation from the start was basically how Islam itself was a radical religion. And so he started pulling out all the verses in the Quran that talked about, you know, battles and, you know, killing the infidels and all of that stuff. And, you know, I think any person who's read any book of, you know, the Abrahamic faiths will know that, first of all, those books have to be read with context. And secondly, that violence is not unique to Islam in terms of the writings and the religious literature. A lot of the battles and the verses that he was pulling out and pointing to as evidence of the radicalism of Islam were verses that were written in contexts of, you know, holy wars and kind of specific to like those battles and all that stuff. And so the context was missing. And this isn't a defense of any of those verses, but I also know enough to know that you can't just pick and choose verses and use them to paint a picture of an entire religion, but that's what he was doing. And then he started talking about the Prophet Muhammad and how he was, you know, he said that he was violent and a pedophile and, you know, all this stuff. And it was just, I just remember sitting there just feeling this intense feeling of like, I just felt like my whole body was like shaking. My face was burning. And it felt like such an assault. Like I just wanted him to stop talking, you know, because everything he said, it just felt like a punch in the face. I just sat there and felt like it was boom, 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 you know, like, and I just wanted it to stop. And so after it was done, I sort of just took this long walk to the far end of the base and I just was just bawling, you know. I was just like, what is this? What is he talking about? You know, remember at the time I was praying and I was feeling very religious and stuff and feeling, you know, a deep sense of faith. And now here was this guy who was just as confident and just as certain as the guy in the wheelchair, but saying the completely opposite thing. So all of a sudden, I just felt like everything that I believed in again was just completely, you know, decimated. And I felt like now I had to start from scratch, but now nothing made any sense, you know, because I don't even know who to believe anymore.
But explain something to me. I mean, it seems like you actually granted this so-called expert a fair bit of authority rather than being simply angry that the military would bring somebody like that to spew this kind of nonsense. You actually internalized it and took it as a real challenge to your faith as you were developing at the time. And was that a creature of the fact that these were thoughts and ideas you had never previously confronted? Or was it a creature of just that you were in a vulnerable state at the time and it was you were relatively easily shaken? Like, why did this provoke introspection on your part rather than just anger?
Right. And, you know, I think it's all of the above. I mean, the key word that you just used was developing, not developed. So I was still developing my opinions on a lot of these things. I was quite impressionable. I'm the kind of person who just by nature always wants to hear every side of every story and really, really takes every side and everything into account before trying to form my own opinion. And I think part of that is because, and this also goes partly to answering your question, you know, I grew up in Egypt and I grew up in a Muslim family that wasn't very religious, but it wasn't religious in the sense that, you know, it's not like my father prayed five times a day or anything like that. I mean, he would go to the mosque on religious holidays and stuff. But religious in the sense that, like, I lived in a Muslim country where that was the truth. There was no space for critical thinking when it came to anything about the religion. And I grew up, you know, we were told, you know, this is the truth, this is the truth, this is the truth, and never given any space to question it and or whether it even was the truth or if there's such a thing as the truth. And we used to have religious classes at school, and the religious classes literally just consisted of us memorizing the Quran. And so there weren't even any discussions about, you know, well, how do you feel about this? I mean, what do you think about that? It was just like, boom, 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 here you go. Memorize this, write it down, pass the exam, and call it a day. And so by the time I had gotten what Iraq had done and what 9/11 had done is that it sort of, for the very first time in my life, kind of showed me or revealed to me that actually maybe there isn't, like, maybe the truth is what you think it is, like the truth for yourself. Maybe there is no such thing as objective truth. And maybe you get to choose what your truth is and what level of religiosity you want to be and what you choose to believe. And that was, on one hand, exciting, but on the other hand, completely terrifying, because when, you know, 21 is young in some ways, but it's quite old in others. So at 21, to be told for the first time that you get to choose your truth really sends you into a tailspin, because you just think, where do I begin? Okay, so now I have to listen to everything that everyone has to say so that I have enough information to come to my own conclusion. And so that's why everything that everyone was saying to me had such oversized impact, I suppose, as compared to, you know, someone else who might have had more of a formulation of their truth. And so to your point, the other translators, the older ones, just got angry and they were yelling at the guy and they were standing up and they were saying, you know, you're insulting Islam. And this, they had no question that what he was saying was untrue. Whereas for me, I still was in that really vulnerable phase of collecting information and really taking it to heart.
So you're extremely good in the piece in that you don't name this individual.
Right, trust me, I've been asked many times, but I won't say.
And I'm not going to ask you to name the individual, though I think you would be obviously well in your rights to, within your rights to do so, but you're also well within your rights to not do so. But I am interested in why you don't name him. I really, for those who have not read this, I commend this part of the piece in particular, just as a, you know, a very vivid portrait of, you know, what bullshit, sloppy, itself ideologically driven, ill-informed assessment of what a religion means does to a young person who, you know, who is subjected to it. I think it's a very strong and upsetting portrait of that. And I guess my question is, why'd you choose not to name him? Why shouldn't the individual be accountable for, you know, going to Guantanamo? I mean, let's be straight about what he did. Going to Guantanamo, giving a lecture in an environment in which people are being, you know, at that time, 600 people or so are detained at Guantanamo. Their cases are being evaluated under both the CSIRT and Administrative Review Board systems. And you're talking to the group of people who are detaining them and conducting these processes and basically describing the entire religious framework in which they're operating, the entire religious civilization in violent terroristic terms. And so my question is, like, why are you being so nice to the guy?
I don't think I'm being nice to him. I don't think that's what it's about. I want to say a couple of things about this point. One of the things that I hate about our collective conversation about religion, whether it was back then or now, or about anything really that is controversial or sensitive, is that we assign too much importance to the individual. And we don't look at the statement or the thing that is being said. We're seeing it through the lens of who is saying it. So for example, sometimes I write pieces and then someone on Twitter will say, oh, I just saw that she is a fellow at the Atlantic Council. Not even going to bother to read this article. Or, I mean, you're on Twitter. I mean, you see a lot of that happening. You know, this person is this or that. And so I don't think the name is important because I don't want to distract. Like, that's not the important thing. That's not what I want people to focus on. It's not about being nice. I want to focus on the problem of what he was saying and what we need to do to combat that problem collectively. You know, he wasn't the only one. You know, I have no doubt that he believed in what he was saying, and that he probably thought he was doing a service to the people in Guantanamo, the soldiers and the people, the officers that were there, by telling them the truth about this religion that they were dealing with. You know, there's a story. It was hard to pick. I had to just pick a couple of stories, but of course, I have a million more. But there was an older translator, an older gentleman on the translator team, who appeared very trustworthy because of his age and sort of appeared very authoritative. And he would tell all the officers that we were working with, you sort of under the guise of educating them about Islam, he would say the same things. He would talk about, you know, the prophet being a pedophile and this and that and the other, because he truly believed that, I think. And so these are the kinds of statements that I think we need to be correcting and fighting against. So even if you bring it to today, when someone, for example, like, you know, the struggle that France is having with Islam right now and its place in France, it really pains me to see that happening, because it brings back so many memories. And so when someone like, you know, Emmanuel Macron says Islam is in crisis, to me, that's just as damaging as what the expert was doing, because you are taking advantage, whether advertently or inadvertently, of the fact that you are an authority figure and you are making a statement that is incredibly damaging and that has implications for so many people. And you're not even of that religion. It's not your place to say that Islam in crisis. That's just not your place to say, especially in this really fraught context within you as French people are having this conversation. So again, just to bring it back, I don't think the name is important. I think what he was saying was important. And then like the question of, okay, so what do we do about statements like these? You know, how do we sort of take the discussion in a more constructive direction without putting too much weight on who is saying it? Because it really doesn't matter who is saying it. A lot of people were saying and are continuing to say the same things. It doesn't, in my mind, serve any purpose of naming them.
All right. So I want to fast forward now quite a few years and talk about the last 4 years in the United States, which on the one hand, you look at and you say, well, these are a real awful 4 years for the acceleration of some of the problems that you're microcosmically describing at Guantanamo. We had the travel ban executive order. We had an entire campaign that the president ran, organized in not entirely, but in significant part on the, you know, Islam is coming to get your mother theme, and, you know, Muslims hate us, right? That's, Trump even said, Islam hates us, right? That
right.
was, his, you know, part of his thing. And you have a significant rise in hate crimes over the last 4 years, although interestingly, not principally directed at Muslim Americans, but there's certainly a rise there. And on the other hand, you have the intense backlash against all of that, right? And the sense on the part of a lot of people who would probably not even know to articulate it, that the embrace of pluralism, including especially those the president has targeted, is an essential quality of the defense of the United States. And so I'm curious, having written this piece and this set of reflections on these incidents at Guantanamo, does the last 4 years make you more concerned, more pessimistic, more optimistic, more encouraged? How should we understand the Trump experience in light of the story that you've told?
I'm glad you asked that, Ben, because in one of the earlier drafts of the article, actually, I didn't have that second anecdote about the expert, the terrorism expert, but instead I had sort of dedicated the second half of the article to what does this mean today for what's happening today. And I think, you know, really, really great credit goes to the New Lines magazine team for really pushing me to just focus on more on what was happening at Guantanamo and just maybe leaving the policy decision to later. So, you know, just to really give it the space that it deserved. So I'm glad you're asking me about it, because the final draft didn't really have much of an implications section, which I think was the right thing to do. But, you know, what I think about when I look at the last 4 years, it feels very familiar to those days that I described in the article in a couple of different ways. There is, of course, the whole fear of the other and trying to demonize someone because we need answers, because the confusion is just too scary. And it's not good enough to say that nuance isn't really rewarded in these circumstances, because people want certainty. In the same way that they want certainty about their identity, they also want certainty about their safety and their life. And they want to know who the enemy is so that they can avoid them or demonize them or go after them or whatever. It's just such a human instinct. And so that very much is happening today. And but not just about Muslims. I mean, like, as you said yourself, if I'm not mistaken, most of the hate crimes that have happened have been against Jews in America, if I think, or African Americans or both. But This is not just about Muslims. It's about this fear of someone who we think doesn't belong to the majority. And the other thing that I feel is really similar is the inability to have a proper conversation about this, because one of the things I said in an earlier draft is that back then you were afraid to oppose the war because then you would be called a traitor. You were afraid of raising your voice because we were at war. And so you really wanted to be on the right side. And conversations were being shut down time and again. And we weren't being allowed to question our leadership or people in positions of authority because they were telling us that they knew best and that they were going to keep us safe. And so I feel like that's really something that's been happening more and more over the last 4 years. And what I hope is going to change under new leadership in the US, at least, is just having the space to speak without fear and have a conversation without being automatically shut down. And that goes for everybody. So for, you know, this whole cancel culture now, where if someone says something that, you know, people don't like, they're canceled and they're never allowed to speak again and they're shamed. That is exactly what was happening back then. And like, look where it got us. Not anywhere good. When you say something, you know, you can be, you're either Islamophobic or anti-Semitic or a traitor, or there's so many labels that are being thrown around in response to someone trying to say how they feel. And even if what they're trying to say is, you know, objectively bad or incorrect, it doesn't serve the conversation. I feel like even as I'm speaking, I feel a little self-conscious because I feel like I'm sounding a bit holier than thou or naive or something like that. But I just like the damage is so great that happens to a society and to people when you're not allowed to have conversations about these things that are really difficult and really complicated. And, you know, that's part of the reason why I decided to write this story. The story is full of like self-doubt and trying to say, you know, I felt this and then I felt this, but then I felt this. And I just feel like we don't really have space to do that. We don't have the space to evolve publicly or to think out loud or anything, because everyone just is so eager for everyone to be on a side so that we know who to fight. And I just find that so incredibly damaging. And that's really what I hope that can change, whether from the top through new national leadership or through articles like mine, not to overstate, you know, how many people will read my article or take any of that stuff into account. But that's what I was trying to hint at without saying it really explicitly.
Well, it's a remarkable article. It's a remarkable story in large measure because of the frankness with which you confront the degree of doubt you have about every aspect of it. And I encourage everybody to check it out. It is in our show notes. A link to it is in the show notes. And you should do some writing for Lawfare because, you know, doubt is our thing.
I'd love to. Thank you, Ben.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is the long-suffering Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by the long-suffering Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by the long-suffering Sophia Yan. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare podcast, so just do it, you know? Share us on social media, leave us a rating or review wherever you found us. It is the season where people buy merch. You should. TheLawfareStore.com. And as always, thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.